Time, times, and halftime. These are the times we're living in. Boy, aren't we lucky. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Great to be back with you, Barry, as always. It's good to be recording another show on this nice, cool morning. We were talking earlier about fall is here, even though it's not officially here yet. It's amazing how fast things change. You know, normally I'm not in Central Ohio over the Labor Day weekend, but this year I was. I'm normally in California where it's, you know, 155 degrees and you know, it doesn't feel like anything except the blazes. And I come back, and when I left, you know, it was 90 plus, and, you know, the nights would cool all the way down to 85 and blah, blah, blah. And by the time I get back, which is a week later, all of a sudden we're in cool nights, and you can begin to feel fall in the air. Well, not disappointed this year because I noticed it change over Labor Day weekend. Yes, it was hot, and it's been hot since, but those evenings are getting cooler and cooler and cooler and cooler. And last night, you know, I went out, got up this morning, fed the dog, checked the temperatures, 54 degrees. So, yes, fall is on the threshold. And I don't have any wood split for the year yet, so I have to get out there and get some wood cut. You want to come help me cut and split wood?
I've been out to your place. You've got plenty of wood to cut.
I got plenty of wood to cut, yeah. I just have to build a platform to keep it on so it doesn't get all mushy.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. Yeah, you're right. It's becoming a lot more beautiful, and it's great because, you know, that just goes to show that God still is in control of everything because the seasons are still changing, and summer is turning into fall, and the leaves are going to be turning, and mowing season's going to be over with, so God is a loving God. I won't have to mow after a while. So
well, that's right.
No, but it's... I'm glad of it, too, because you know me, and I think some of our listeners know, I'm a fall guy. I love this crisp weather. I love cold mornings and cool evenings. I love not, you know, feeling like you're about to, like, pant yourself to death in the middle of the afternoon, and it's not reaching, you know, 94 degrees with 80% humidity, which brings it up to about 106. I love those. I especially love it because, well, fall's a great time for me because I like going out in the woods and climbing into a tree and hunting deer and walking in the woods. You're right. With this weather change, my son and I just went up to our woods here over the weekend and walked around and checked things and decided where we're going to put another stand in our woods for you know, accommodating friends who want to come over to do some deer hunting. And, you know, it's just great time of the year. And it's good because those are things we can count on, Chuck. God has got all of nature and all of life in control, and we can count on these things. And it's a good thing too, because otherwise we'd have to count on men for everything. And boy, aren't we going to be in a mess if that's the case. And you know, the first thing that brings to mind here as we get into fall, you know, we also get into cold and flu season, right? And of course, it looks like an early victim of our flu season happens to be one of the presidential candidates, Hillary Rodham Clinton, only if you believe her husband, Bill, that the medical issues that have suddenly arisen around her and become focus are actually just, oh, well, you know, it's a bout of the flu and everybody gets the flu. And, you know, why are we making such a big deal out of it? As a matter of fact, that's what Clinton said the other day in a speech, where he was being a surrogate for his wife because she's not well enough to travel to go to these, you know, high-dollar fundraising events and public forums. And it got me to thinking about an article that you and I had looked over, and we hadn't talked about yet on this program, but I think today's a good day to do that. It was an article from U.S. News and World Report written by Steve Nelson, who was a staff writer, and this was only written a couple weeks ago. Funny, right before all this stuff with Hillary Clinton's cough and pneumonia and, you know, neurological issue. Well, you know, at least that's how it's being reported, that maybe she's got some significant neurological degenerative issue. And the article headlined is, "A Candidate's Death Could Delay or Eliminate the Presidential Election." And I thought we should talk about that today because we've had some people ask, well, what happens if Hillary or Donald or whoever die while they're on the campaign trail? You know, is it just automatic that the running mate becomes the nominee? And the answer to that, Chuck, I believe, is not so much. Because I think it kicks us back into a scenario, and I think this writer would agree in some extent that what we end up facing is if a candidate has to withdraw because they, well, perish, or even if they become too sick to go forward and it becomes evident, and, you know, rumor has it, or there's been some word out that there have been some high-level meetings at the Democrat National Committee over the last few days regarding Hillary Clinton's health and whether or not, you know, they need to stand behind her or ask her to step aside. It doesn't mean that Tim Kaine automatically becomes the Democratic nominee, or if Donald Trump's when he releases his medical report, which is supposed to happen, we're recording this on Thursday, it's supposed to happen today on the Dr. Oz show, that he's releasing his medical records. You know, if we find out that Donald Trump is, you know, an inch away from death with some, you know, debilitating disease as well, it doesn't necessarily mean Mike Pence becomes the nominee, because really, Chuck, and, you know, the Constitution really doesn't say anything to this unless an individual dies while holding the office of president. It's really up to the parties to determine who's going to continue to carry the banner for their party into the election.
Okay, what you're illustrating, and what a lot of people don't understand, and again, if you want to understand this better, I give a lecture on this, on the Electoral College and how the election process is supposed to work. And if you want to hear about that, www.principletopolicy.com, I would be more than happy to come to talk to your group and give my little talk on the Electoral College and why it works the way it does, how it's broken, why it still works, those kinds of things. But what you're illustrating is the fact that the electoral system has been hijacked by the party system, because our system was actually designed to not have parties involved. Here's what would happen in a case if we were have a constitutional presidential election. That is, electors would go in and choose three candidates for president. And since the 12th Amendment, three candidates for vice president, okay? What the 12th Amendment did was basically reduce the number of candidates that you would pick, and it also allowed for the creation of the party system by allowing you to pick a running mate. Normally, the way in the original constitutional system, the candidate who got the most number of votes over 50%, 50% plus one of the Electoral College, was the president, and the one who got the second number of votes was the vice president. Well, that's...
And so we had situations where you had a Federalist and an Anti-Federalist serving at the same time.
Absolutely, we did.
Or Democrat, Republican, and Federalist serving at the same time. Yeah, as the parties as the names changed, as the groups changed over time, you know, Whigs, et cetera, and then you got up to, you know, with the formation of the Republican Party around the 1850s, you could have a Republican and a Democrat serving together up until the 12th Amendment.
So honestly, if we had constitutional elections, this wouldn't even be a question. None of these questions that this article, you know, talks about, the courts intervening and blah 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 blah, none of that would be necessary, because the electors would simply pick someone else. They would pick the non-dead candidate. In fact, it's interesting this comes up today, because I was reading an article this morning out of a paper, and don't remember where it was from, but basically it talked about a candidate who had committed suicide but got picked.
Won the race. Yeah,
but
exactly.
won the election to be the candidate in November anyway. And he had committed suicide weeks and weeks before. And this is not unprecedented. Mel Carnahan won re-election to the Senate, the United States Senate from Missouri.
Yes.
After he'd been killed in a plane crash, like weeks before, and basically his wife filled out the term. I don't understand this thing about having wives fill out terms.
You're talking about Claire McCaskill.
No, I'm talking about McClanahan. Maybe I am talking about
No, you're talking about it's Claire McCaskill. Her husband was the sitting senator, and he died in a plane crash, and she ended up being subbed in for him and won, and she's still the sitting U.S. senator from Missouri.
I'm thinking something else. I'm guessing.
Okay. Okay. Well, yeah, because you're not talking about Paul Wellstone, who was a Democrat.
No.
Senator from Minnesota.
Paul Wellstone died and was quickly turned. They ran somebody else, and he got creamed by. I'm trying to remember who it was, a one-termer, because that's the seat that Al Franken sits in. It's Paul Wellstone's old seat, mm-hmm. but there was somebody in between, and I don't remember who it was. Which tells you that political fame is fleeting, but that being the case,
Well, you forget, because his name was Tim Pawlenty.
Tim Pawlenty
ran for president.
That's right. That Tim Pawlenty, yeah, one termer. He didn't run for president.
Who then tried to run for president and didn't last quite a term. So.
Yeah, and unfortunately, and I always laugh when I hear. Al Franken waxing eloquently about stolen elections. He's often up on his soapbox talking about how ballots are being rigged and blah, blah, blah. He won in a rigged election. There's no doubt about that. Ballots were, shall we say, were found in trunks of cars. Suddenly, oh gosh, we found these boxes of ballots in the back of an election worker's car and they didn't get counted. We need to throw these in. So yeah, Al Franken stole the election from Tim Pawlenty. But that being said, let's go back to where we were. Yes. This candidate's death thing.
Yes.
It would be in the hands of the party, because the party is who is proffering this candidate.
And, yeah, that's true.
And the fact is, my guess would be, now, there's already been speculation who would take the reins. Of course, Tim Kaine would love to do it, but chances are it would be somebody like sitting Vice President Joe Biden.
Oh, of course. And Chuck, if you think about it, I was actually having a conversation yesterday with my mechanic, but that's another story we won't go into.
Yeah.
Mechanic. But I was having this conversation because, he's kind of politically interested, and he knows what I do and how involved I am. And he was asking me, he was like, well, if she drops out, then does the other guy get in? And I said, well, no, not necessarily. And I said, think about it this way. Why would have Hillary Clinton have picked Tim Kaine in the first place? I mean, that was definitely a pick that came from the Clinton camp.
Oh, absolutely.
They owed him. They owed him. He was the former DNC chair who cleared the way so that Debbie Wasserman Schultz could move into the DNC so that Hillary could get things lined up for this run. And he did his job dutifully, and he was rewarded first by, getting the Senate seat in Virginia, and then secondly by then being nominated to the ticket, which I think was probably part of the deal that was cut for him to step aside of the DNC, is that promise that he'd be put on a ticket in the upcoming future. Now, if you think about that significantly, because if you look at the electoral map, Chuck, and we're talking about electors here, what big plus did Tim Kaine bring to the Democratic ticket? He doesn't bring any, draw for ethnicity, doesn't bring any draw for gender. He doesn't bring any draw for certain special interest groups. Let's face it, that was what would be considered a vanilla or mundane or safe pick by the Clinton camp. Somebody who really couldn't pull it off on their own.
Well, it was a political chit, so a chit was paid off. I'm not sure that the fix wasn't in for that from many years ago. So don't worry, Tim. We'll make sure you're taken care of when Hillary gets in the office. There's other things involved here, and that is that. He hasn't done a really good job in going out and he looks a little embarrassed when he's making excuses for Hillary and why certain things are going on with Hillary. you know, with her health, with her refusal to show up in down in Louisiana, down in you know, along the Mississippi, that when the bayou flooded out. Those kinds of things. He makes these excuses. Well, she can't be everywhere at once and blah, 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 blah. And he just looks a little like he's lost. But that being the case, he's also supposed... Now, see, if I'd been her, I'd have sent him. Because he looks like the pillar of strength that's propping her up in that kind of a case. You know, you can't say that about Joe Biden. Joe Biden couldn't prop anybody up. Early in the first term, he was known as Crazy Joe because he couldn't keep his mouth shut. And he'd say stupid things. And he still does say stupid things. The press just doesn't, like, make a big deal out of it. But that being said, yeah, this was a political chit that got paid off because Tim Kaine knew where a lot of the bodies were buried, knew some of the stuff that had been done to get the job done for Hillary. And I'm not so sure that Tim Kaine's clean as a whistle ethically. I think he's had some issues, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it's a possibility. But what it really gets down to is the party, the DNC, would have to convene a special meeting to pick a replacement for Hillary Clinton. And, you know, with the superdelegates, and right now at the DNC, there are 445 committee members. So basically, all you'd have to have is a majority of the members gather, which is 223.
Yeah.
So you get 223 members in a special meeting, and then the majority of them, you know, if 50% of them vote for, you know, picking Joe Biden to replace, or pick Bernie Sanders, or pick Michelle Obama. I'm going to go back to a wild speculation I made a long time ago, Chuck. There still could be an opening for that.
Well, yeah.
and, you know, you just have to wonder, you know, is the DNC looking at the Clinton camp and looking at the Clinton campaign now and seeing the poll numbers changing radically? Donald Trump is starting to pull away and win in states that they didn't figure he had a clue in. He's up 5 points, according to the latest Bloomberg News poll, in Ohio, Chuck.
Yeah.
Now, that's a state where the sitting governor is not a big fan of Donald Trump, and the state Republican Party really hasn't lifted a finger to help the Trump campaign.
Well, and let's take it further to where it actually goes. The sitting governor of the state of Ohio, the head of the Republican Party in the state.
Right, de facto head.
De facto
right.
head has basically said, Trump's not going to win here and I'm not going to campaign for him. Well, he's backpedaling on the Trump's not going to win here thing. He's no longer right. saying that.
Yeah, they're watching the polls too.
Yeah, and it's beginning to look more and more and more like Governor Kasich may end up with egg on his face over this whole mess. Because when he runs for Senate in 2 years, which he's going to do, perhaps people will remember this. But that being said, this whole thing with president and vice president candidates withdrawing or not being able to fulfill is not unprecedented at all. In fact, those of us who are old enough to remember 1972 can remember when this happened. Do you remember what happened in 1972?
Well, no, I was pretty young then.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you youngsters.
You youngsters.
Okay. A man was nominated for vice president named Thomas Eagleton on the Democratic right. ticket. McGovern Eagleton. Now, who actually was on the ballot in November? Do you remember? McGovern and?
Sergeant Shriver.
Our Sergeant Shriver. Okay. Who was a Kennedy Klan member by marriage. Okay. What happened to Thomas Eagleton? Well, it was discovered that at one time Thomas Eagleton had some kind of a mental breakdown. And Thomas Eagleton had received shock treatments in a mental hospital.
Yeah, electroshock therapy. Yes.
And he was a senator from Missouri, if I remember correctly. Yeah, he was a senator from Missouri.
Yes.
And
yes.
he received
Funny how all the senators from Missouri keep coming back here.
That's it. He had received electroshock therapy treatments. to deal with whatever, I forget what the mental issue was. I'm thinking it was depression, but I don't remember for sure. Seems like a kind of a swatting a fly with a 10-pound hammer to me. But depression can be very debilitating and that kind of thing, if that's what it was. I'm not going to look it up because it's not important. If you want to look it up, Thomas Eagleton. But what happened was Eagleton was basically forced out over these revelations. Okay, so what happened? Well, as I recall, the Democratic National Committee got back together. However many members they have, and you mentioned it, and they picked another candidate. And they went back and forth and blah, 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 and our Sergeant Shriver was the guy. Well, essentially, McGovern was viewed as having abandoned Eagleton because he had performed in the Senate just as a good liberal. And I think they picked him because he was, quote, unquote, moderate, and you know what that means. He wasn't as far left of center as McGovern, so... By contrast, he was a moderate, and he had done his job just fine while he was there. And I think he was reelected to the Senate after that. So it was made to look as if McGovern had essentially abandoned Eagleton, and in fact, that's what happened. And they replaced him with Sergeant Shriver, who was the only guy they could find who would actually take the job. I mean, that's the bottom line. That's who they got. They got Sergeant Shriver, who basically said, "I'll take one for the team," because by this time they're pretty sure they're not gonna prevail. The talk is always out there, Barry. We're gonna win. We're gonna win. We're gonna win. We're gonna win. You know, we never talk defeat. Blah 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 blah. Even think John McCain in 2008. Think Mitt Romney in 2012. We can win it, we can win it, we can win it. I mean, Karl Rove is probably still standing there with his whiteboard waiting for the results from Ohio to come in and elect Mitt Romney president. Hey, Karl, it's over, dude. Been over. Not going to happen. So this is not an unprecedented thing. And what I'm seeing, though, is shocking to me in this article. And what I'm seeing is people who are literally calling for, if a candidate has to withdraw, we need to quote unquote delay the presidential election by up to 4 weeks. Okay, why? Why? There is an electoral college requirement that those votes have to be counted by December.
Exactly.
Period.
I think it's December the 10th, isn't it?
Oh gosh, it's not set in stone like that. It's okay.
X number of days after the after the election.
Yeah.
So I think it's right around December the 9th or the 10th.
You know, the presidential election could be delayed or scrapped altogether if conspiracy theories become predictive and a candidate dies or drops out before November 8th. I don't understand why. Why would it be delayed or scrapped? Now, if by scrap they means it goes directly to the Electoral College, that's what the Electoral College is designed for.
Well, and I think that's the key right there, Chuck. And the reason why I wanted to bring this article up was I think it was hilarious because there's a quote in this article, way down in the article, from a law professor at Ohio State University by the name of Edward Foley. And he says, quote, "The Supreme Court has never ruled that electors can be forced to obey their pledge to vote for a particular presidential candidate, leaving open the door for mass defections or, in the event of a post-election candidate death, an en masse vote flip." Well, Chuck, that was the way the Electoral College was designed. That's part of the reason why the Supreme Court has never ruled on that. They can't say you must obey your vote when an elector goes in and those votes are cast. And remember, folks, they don't go to D.C. to cast these votes. Usually they end up going to the state, capital after the November election, after the votes are tallied and each state's Secretary of State has certified the election. Then the electors are called together on the same day in December. They go to their state capital and they cast their ballots, and it's usually cast for the national winner. We usually don't have a big situation where, except for, the hanging chad issue in Florida in the 2000 election, where there's a question of whether or not the person who won the most votes in most states actually is going to win the Electoral College and then become the president. So that's usually what happens. And so if there's a death before the election, after the election but before the votes are certified, after the election but before the Electoral College meets, the Electoral College can pick whomever they feel like. They're not bound. You know, and if it comes a situation that, you know, let's take the scenario Hillary Clinton wins on November the 8th and dies on November the 12th. Okay. Do they have to, like, go back and redo the election all over again? No, because the Electoral College will be there. Now, the Democratic Party will say, you know, this is who, you know, Kane, who was the VP nominee, then becomes our candidate, because really they couldn't do much else without creating massive turmoil with
right.
their party.
Right.
And then it's up to the electors, okay, am I voting for Tim Kaine to be president and then to pick somebody to be his VP later, or am I now a free agent and I'm going to, you know, vote for somebody else? That can happen.
And you know what?
And then
we
there's
have
a scenario of
yeah.
the electors meet, pick somebody, and then the House of Representatives receives those votes and they open them up at a duly appointed date, and then the president is actually the new president sworn in on the 20th of January. What happens if after the House receives those votes, but before the 20th of January, the president-elect dies? Well, that's simple. The vice president-elect becomes the president because the Constitution has a rule about those things.
Yeah. And it's amazing how well it's all covered. I mean, they anticipated these things. I mean, they anticipated, you know, what if, for instance, William Henry Harrison had died of pneumonia before he was sworn in? You know, remember, that's our 31-day president.
Right. Well, John Tyler would have become president earlier.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what would have happened.
That's exactly what would have happened. So.
And that was after the 12th Amendment. Remember, and, you know, Tyler ran as a, I believe, as a Whig, and William Henry Harrison was a Whig. But what happened to John Tyler immediately after almost immediately after he vetoed a couple of bills, what happened to him? He was thrown out of the Whig Party, so he served as a president without party. A lot of people don't know that. He was no longer allowed to be in the Whig Party. So very these interesting things in history, we look at them as if they're unprecedented, and they're not. We have these quote unquote experts who are coming out and telling us we need to do this, we need to postpone elections, we need to have all this law. The law is already there. Everything's covered.
That's right. The Constitution already covers these situations.
Let's talk about this. If something happened to the vice presidential candidate, what could be done? Well, the Electoral College could step in and say, okay, we're going to do our Electoral College duty, and we're going to elect a vice president. So if somebody gets 50% plus one of the vice presidential ballots who isn't nominated, isn't one of the nominees, he's vice president. That's how powerful the Electoral College is. And everybody looks at it as this little formality. It's not. This kind of a scenario shows that the Electoral College is broken, but it still works because it's there for this kind of stuff. That's the beauty of the Constitution as it sits. And we leave these depths unplumbed because we've never seen these situations before, and we've got people who are quote-unquote experts who are coming out and telling us, oh, we need to do this, we need to do that, we need to do another thing because it's not covered in the Constitution. Oh, yes, it is. And therein lies the problem, Barry.
Indeed. Now, we have another problem that's breaking, too, because it's not just the general public who doesn't seem to understand the Constitution. It now seems like many of our congressional leaders really don't understand the Constitution very well either, and some of them have a tin ear. And I say that because as we're recording today, Thursday, today, Chuck, was supposed to have been historic day on the Hill in Congress, because a resolution that was coming from the some of the members of the House Freedom Caucus, led by Ohio's Jim Jordan, they had put forth a resolution, which was called a privileged resolution, which means it's one that takes precedence. And their resolution was a move for the impeachment of the commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, one John Koskinen. Now, I think our folks who listen to our radio program, know about the historic travails that have been happening over the last, over 2 years, Chuck, with the question of whether or not the Internal Revenue Service was, some say playing favorites and the others say on a witch hunt to deny certain groups because of their philosophical and political leanings, nonprofit status. Were they holding up nonprofit approvals for certain groups like Tea Party groups or groups that they consider to be right wing, where they were green lighting liberal groups and giving them no hassles and speedy passage through the IRS process in order to become a recognized a 501c something or other.
Who was one of those groups?
I say that because there's like 15 different 501c somethings. Everybody thinks a C3, but there's a lot of them.
So. Right. Who was one of those groups?
Well, the Institute.
The Institute for Principled Policy, who sponsors this program, who we sit on the board of, was one of those groups that got a harassment letter from the Internal Revenue Service under Lois Lerner, who was allowed to skate.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, she lost her job, but she was allowed to skate, and she'll land soft. Don't worry about Lois.
Yep.
But the fact is, we got one of those things.
Indeed.
And so we wanted to know what books we had for sale, and went into the philosophy of the group, and blah blah blah, all this stuff.
And we did our best to answer those questions by dead silence.
Yeah, we did.
We chose not to respond because we knew better than to respond. And as a matter of fact, we knew better than to respond because we had been given advice by a number of attorneys that said they can't ask you these questions.
We actually dropped our C4 designation.
Yeah, absolutely. We just said, hey, forget it. If this is what this is what it's coming to, then we don't need to operate that way. So anyhow, but right now there's a resolution. Jim Jordan brings it along with the House Freedom Caucus that is a privilege resolution that has supposed to today's today that the House is supposed to take up the resolution and vote to impeach John Koskinen. Not so fast, Chuck. The problem, you see, is that, bringing this up right now, it's going to be difficult, and I don't know if we can move forward on this because, we might irritate some voters right before the election. Now, that's not me saying that, Chuck. That's House leadership. That's the Paul Ryans and the leadership team who have now postponed the impeachment vote that was scheduled today through 11th-hour backroom dealings that happened last night, and we're recording this on Thursday, so that was Wednesday night. Now the situation is we're not going to have the vote today, but what we're going to do is we're going to send it over to the House Judiciary Committee to hold hearings on whether or not we should impeach John Koskinen. Now, Chuck, stop me if I miss something here, but the House Government Oversight Committee is the one who was handling these investigations to start with and have already had hearings and interviews with Lerner and Koskinen and everybody else. So tell me how this is any positive that we're going to stop an impeachment. And honestly, Chuck, think about this. If that resolution was brought to the floor today, it would pass because all it takes is a simple majority. And there are enough members in Congress who would say yes to that, including some Democrats who might be able to think outside the box. They would impeach John Koskinen. He would be impeached. Now, the question is, then it goes to the Senate for a trial, and it takes 2/3 in the Senate, and most likely it would be difficult to, A, get the Senate to move on it prior to the election to start with, because I don't believe there's a specific timeline of how short a time they have to take up the hearing against an impeached individual. But the question then remains with 2/3 vote, if they push it beyond the election, most likely the Democrats are not going to vote in favor of conviction because it's not in their best interest.
Well, they're not going to
anyway.
But if
you get them before the election, if you get them before the election, then that puts them in a rougher position.
It
at least a
certainly
third of them,
does.
As a matter of fact.
It certainly does. It puts them in a position. And all you have to do is read this article. We're going to put it at the bottom of the in the article links when this gets posted.
Oh, yeah.
And by the way, I'm almost caught up with posting. So sorry, folks, for being so far behind, but they're almost all up. That being said, the deal came only after conservatives predicted that their impeachment resolution was going to get sidelined by Democratic and Republican opposition Thursday. Republican opposition? Where would Republican opposition come from?
From the House leadership.
House leadership.
From Paul Ryan and his leadership team, who specifically stated that they are, and their argument for not wanting to bring this vote up was that they might irritate voters before the election. Okay, Chuck, stop and think for a minute. Is this the most tin-eared, transparent, specious rationale that you could possibly have? Because if I'm Paul Ryan, who's supposed to be the head of the congressional Republicans, and I've got all of my Republicans up for election because every member of the House is up this year, and I know that the vast majority of the public is starting, the trend is starting to turn toward Donald Trump. He's starting to win in all these states. The polls are showing him walking away. And the vast majority of those supporters are folks who, for them, if you impeach the head of the IRS, they would basically throw you a party.
Yes.
That he might irritate. Pray tell, Paul Ryan, who in the name of all that's holy are you going to be irritating besides the hardcore left?
And that's the whole point. These people, you're going to be irritating people who aren't going to vote for the Republican standard bearer for the presidency anyway.
Well, yeah, and the point is, are you going to help your folks out on the campaign trail? Of course you are, because even liberals, when they actually start, you know, making their own money and not getting off the government somehow, start realizing that taxes aren't fun. And having to go every year and fill out paperwork for the IRS isn't a happy thing.
Exceedingly complex paperwork.
Even among liberals, Chuck, there are probably a significant demographic in of liberals who would be happy to see the commissioner of the IRS get impeached. You know, if to do nothing else but to basically reassert Congress's role as a watchdog over an executive agency.
Well, if anything, rank and file Democrats would. You wouldn't find people who are
absolutely. Wait a minute, rank and file. You mean the blue collar Democrats who are,
right.
By the way, voting for Donald Trump? I mean, is that what we're talking about? Is those Democrats?
That's exactly who I'm talking about. I'm talking about the old
Reagan
coalition. The Reagan
Democrats is what we called those in the past.
Exactly.
So we might irritate the hardcore leftists by doing something that would basically make it a windfall electorally for Republicans and those Reagan Democrat type candidates.
Well,
I knew this was coming, Chuck, because like I said yesterday, I'm talking to my McCann. Again, we talked about politics. It wasn't just about Hillary and her health. But I told him, I said, listen, I said, I don't know if you heard about it or not, but there's supposedly a vote coming up tomorrow. And I said, the direction that vote takes, and if that vote happens, will tell you exactly what's going to happen after the presidential election. I said, because if the House leadership allows that vote to go on to the floor, they're sending a strong message that Congress is going to stand up to either Hillary Clinton or to Donald Trump because they are going to exercise their authority. If leadership balks, and I said these words yesterday, like I was there.
Yeah.
1:30 in the afternoon. Yesterday afternoon at 1:30, so these whole deals hadn't even happened yet. If House leadership balks and decides to try to make this go away, I said, that's a signal that they're saying that they will bend over backwards and roll over for whoever takes the office of the presidency, regardless if it's Hillary Clinton or not.
Bingo.
And that's exactly what we have seen today. We're going to send this to the House Judiciary Committee because, Koskinen deserves to have that kind of a hearing, you know. And it's like, okay, so what they were actually doing is, this is our way of delaying, because if we push it to committee, we can hold it in committee for 3 or 4 weeks, and then we come back and we can delay the vote on the floor, and we can hopefully get past the election before we even vote on whether or not to impeach him. And at that point in time, after the election, you know,
it won't matter.
They don't care anymore.
Yeah.
It won't matter anymore.
Well,
and that's really the frustration, I think, that the vast majority of the American voters who are paying any attention at all have with the existing leadership in this country. And I don't care if it's Republican or Democrat, Nancy Pelosi or Paul Ryan. The point is, you have a job to do. You have a constitutionally mandated responsibility. You have members who want to exercise that responsibility and that authority. And the leadership is the one who's not leading. They're the ones who are being the obstructionists. They're the ones who are throwing up the roadblocks and deferring and trying to avoid taking a public vote on a matter that has significance. Do we allow a rogue agency like the Internal Revenue Service, which has phenomenal amounts of power and control over the American economy and the American populace, to be able to play politics when they feel like it? Or is Congress going to rein them in and tell them, you cannot be an intimidating, harassing force to the American voter or to the American public? You don't even have to be a voter to want to see the IRS be reined in. Or is Congress going to basically say, no, we want to play the get along game with the executive branch,
right?
And we're going to wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Oh yeah, we're going to be tough on them. We're going to hold hearings. We're going to hold hearings. Well, Chuck, we've been holding hearings all summer.
Yeah.
Started last spring, all summer long. Lois Lerner, everybody else, Koskinen has been in there. The time for hearings is over with. The time for a vote needs to happen. And it doesn't matter what the Senate will or will not do with the impeachment. It is the responsibility of the House, because that's where impeachments have to start. It's the responsibility of the House to carry through on their duty. They're being called to it.
And you've said
the
something,
current leadership won't allow it.
This is not something that you do for political gain. This is a requirement of the Constitution. This House and Senate are required to oversee the activities of government, the activities of the executive branch and of the judicial branch, and they are to discipline them. This is their duty. It's not merely something there that is there for political manipulation. This is why Bill Clinton was was impeached in 1997, I think it was, 97 or 98.
Okay, Chuck, I'm up on my hot box right now, so give me a couple seconds here to vent. The argument that's being made by House leadership is one that I've heard many times before from leaders, quote unquote, at the state and the federal level, which is, well, we can't do our duty because some other body won't go along with it. Now, I've heard that. Hey, we can't pass the heartbeat bill in the Ohio legislature because the courts will veto it. They'll knock it down. You know what? It's not your duty and responsibility as a legislator to predict and do crystal ball on what the courts will and will not do with an issue. It's your duty to pass the issues that are constitutionally sound, send them up, let somebody bring them to the courts, and if the courts rule badly, it's your job to turn around and rein in the court. You know, if the courts say heartbeat bill is unconstitutional, Congress turns around and takes the abortion regulation issue out of the hands of the federal courts, sends it back to the states, or they pass another law that changes it slightly and says, we are still going to send this up because this is the will of Congress and the will of the American people. And that really is what it gets down to, Chuck. When these leaders say, we can't do this because, and they start pointing the blame at another entity, whether it's the court, the Senate, whatever have you, what they've basically said is, we are abdicating our responsibility and our duty that you elected us for and that you're paying us to do. And that should be grounds for at least maybe the House Freedom Caucus to determine that that's a vote of no confidence in their leadership, and they need new leaders. Leaders who are willing to make the hard calls and do the tough decisions and stand up to it regardless. Hey, who knows what the Senate will do? If the House puts a backbone on and passes an impeachment resolution today on the floor of the House and sticks it in the Senate's hands, then what can happen? There'll be an outcry from the American people of why the Senate's not moving on convicting a man who, and this is what the caucus put out, Chuck, that this, a man who misled Congress, allowed evidence pertinent to an investigation to be destroyed, and defied congressional subpoenas and preservation orders. Those are part of the case against John Koskinen. Now, why they, and I understand the Freedom Caucus is now back down and they're supporting the leadership, which I have trouble with. But they're basically saying, well, yeah, the American public deserves the opportunity to hear him answer under oath. He's been, you've called him under oath. He's done all these things. What makes you think when you call him back into a different committee, the House Judiciary Committee, and you swear him under oath that he won't do the exact same thing? And once a document's been destroyed, Chuck, it's destroyed.
It's destroyed, it's gone.
Unless it's electronic, and then you might be able to find it, unless Hillary doesn't turn it over or something of that.
Well, just ask Sandy Berger, who basically got the nickname Sandy Burglar for stealing documents from the National Archives, which have never been located.
And they never will either, because they've been run through a shredder, most likely.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up, because I happened to catch something just a minute ago, because, as this show goes on, we're constantly scanning for the latest. And here's an article out of a McClatchy newspaper, McClatchy, D.C. Now, the McClatchy newspapers are, shall we say, not bulwarks of conservatism. In fact, they're almost
Democrat. Say that, yeah.
Yeah, they're essentially far left liberal mouthpieces. What you just read, you're going on a Fox News article. Now, get this.
Yes, that was from Fox. I apologize. I should have noticed that was Fox News.
Here's the far left take.
Okay.
The conservative House Freedom Caucus celebrated the development as a win late Wednesday, as conservatives had long pushed GOP leaders for impeachment hearings against Koskinen. They accuse him of obstructing a congressional investigation into the treatment of the Tea Party group seeking tax exemptions. Do you really think the House Freedom Caucus celebrated this as a win? They had a privileged motion which basically was going to require impeachment.
Right.
And it was going to pass. It couldn't not pass. The only way it couldn't pass is if House leadership managed to do some kind of a procedural vote to sideline it, which was the plan, which would expose the leadership for what they are, which was also part of the plan. So do you really think that the House Freedom Caucus celebrated the development as a win?
Well, I have to say that publicly, yeah, they did. And they're trying to, and you know what? It's called putting lipstick on a pig, Chuck.
Yes.
they're trying to spin this the best way possible that, we brought them to the negotiating table and they capitulated by, we came out with our strongest and they gave us the thing we were really looking for, which was public hearings. And it's like, you have public hearings. You had subpoena power. He denies subpoenas. That really... turning around and saying, well, then we're going to send it to another committee to subpoena the same guy. That's not the step. The step is impeachment because he's a public official.
Okay, here's a quote. It doesn't say who they're quoting. The Freedom Caucus said, oh, the Freedom Caucus. Okay, my apologies. Quote, this hearing will give every American the opportunity to hear John Koskinen answer under oath why he misled Congress, allowed evidence pertinent to an investigation to be destroyed, and defied congressional subpoenas and preservation orders, the Freedom Caucus said in a statement. Quote, it will be also remove any lingering excuses for those who have been hesitant to proceed with this course of action. End quote. Okay. The fact is, what the Freedom Caucus has just said is, our resolution should have passed. Fine. If you want to go the extra step and play this game, we'll play. But we're not happy about it, and we're basically going to show why this impeachment vote should have taken place immediately. Now, where do I see that? In the wording of this document, they're basically saying it's a foregone conclusion. We already know these things happened. Once you know this kind of government mismanagement has taken place, and not just simply mismanagement, malfeasance.
Yes.
It's not misfeasance. It's malfeasance. It had a specific outcome in mind. Because when this malfeasance occurred, it's their duty to impeach it immediately. Now, we can play these games. It has to go through the Judiciary Committee. The House Government and Oversight Committee has already made its determination. There needs to be an impeachment vote. Now, you got to wait until after the November election because someone might be upset. Well, of course people are going to be upset. Okay. What they're basically saying is...
Chuck, let me...
Go ahead.
Let me throw this in. Because the compromise is that there will be hearings starting next week in the House Judiciary Committee, right?
Yeah.
On Koskinen, for him to come forward so that the American public can learn about why he did all these bad things, right?
Supposedly.
I want to make sure I got my fact pattern correct, right?
Yeah.
I think that's what it said. Okay. Now, the House Judiciary Committee is chaired by Senator Bob Goodlatte from Virginia. I just went over to Bob Goodlatte's official webpage, and I just Googled in the words Bob Goodlatte on IRS, and what's the first thing that pops up is a press release from Bob Goodlatte's public office saying the House Judiciary Committee today announced that it will hold two full committee hearings to examine misconduct by the Internal Revenue Service Commissioner John Koskinen. What's the bydine date, Chuck?
May 13th, 2016.
They've already had these meetings. One took place Tuesday, May 24th at 10 a.m., and the second hearing was going to be scheduled right after that. I'm sorry, but it's already been there. They invited him to testify. They basically have sent this. They had the report from the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee's investigation. All of this happened, and then the second hearing was supposed to take place. That was May 24th. Second hearing was supposed to take place in June. And then they were basically going to have to see if more further congressional action is warranted. Okay. May, Chuck, May.
Yeah. Send me that, please,
link. Why are we going back to the House Judiciary Committee again in September when... We are already gone through this once.
Well, Barry,
okay, now we're going to get serious. We invited him the last time. Now we're going to subpoena him. It's like, well, he ignored a direct request from Congress to come and present himself as to results of an investigation into his activity and his conduct. I'm sorry, Chuck. I think that's strike number three already.
Well, that's contempt of Congress. The guy should look. I've seen all kinds of shenanigans going on. This is what soured me on Trey Gowdy when things were going on with the email scandal. Well, we asked these people to come testify. We issued subpoenas and they don't come, or they don't bring the stuff we asked, and they won't answer the questions. People have gone to jail for contempt of Congress.
Yes, they
Why
have.
Aren't contempt of Congress charges being brought against these people at the very least?
Well, because I guess they don't even have the intestinal fortitude, the backbone, to even bring a contempt of Congress resolution against this IRS head, much less an impeachment resolution. I mean, come on, Chuck. Who's kidding who here? What's happened is the leadership of one of the chambers of Congress have shown that they do not understand their constitutional responsibilities. They don't understand how the Constitution works. I mean, we have clear evidence from, and because one committee has already held hearings, the second committee has already held the hearing. Now the committee that we're sending them back to has already held hearings. You know, okay, so he's going to be under oath. I mean, did he agree to this? It says that he will testify before Congress next week. Are they sending him a subpoena that they will arrest him if he doesn't come? Because they've already asked him to come once, and he basically blew them off.
Yeah, he said no.
But the point is, everything points back to him. Yeah, and here's another article out from Congressman Bob Goodlatte's office, dated May the 20th, saying, on the 24th, we're going to hold the hearing and do all of this issue. And you know, we've basically found that Commissioner Koskinen failed to comply with a congressional subpoena. He's already failed to comply with a congressional subpoena. They've known this since the spring, Chuck. But here we go, once again, playing the spin. Because we have leadership, and I'm putting that in air quotes, leadership that doesn't understand the Constitution, refuses to follow the Constitution, and then looks down on people and, you know, creates animosity to people who call them to hold the Constitution, like a Jim Jordan of the House Freedom Caucus. I mean, come on.
Well, Barry, okay, you know what I see involved in this partly? There is some kind of trembling fear in what the press will do to them if they do all this stuff in an election year. Oh, my gosh, come on, guys. You're going to get pilloried no matter what you do. This is not the reason to hold back on doing your constitutionally appointed duty, and that is government oversight. And reining in the judiciary and the executive branch when they're abusing power. And this is clearly an abuse of power. My gosh, Barry. It's just amazing to me that these people continue to be, you know, they want to be reelected and reelected and reelected, but they want to do as little as possible and yet still keep the people on the string. Who will continue to quote unquote support them. I don't understand why, for instance, Paul Ryan thinks that he's going to get a plus out of not prosecuting an IRS commissioner. Seriously.
Right. No, I don't get that either. Well,
as they see real quick, cause we're almost out of time, but real quick, what I see is they want the executive branch to be able to use the IRS for the same thing when the Republicans are in power as when the Democrats are in power.
That's true. And let me wrap this up, because the hearing they had, the second hearing, first hearing in May, Koskinen refused to appear. Second hearing they had in June, they brought in legal experts, and it says, quote unquote, and this is from the Daily Caller of all places, so it's not a conservative outlet either. But basically, this was on the June hearing that was in the House Judiciary about this issue. Now, of course, this was the House Oversight Committee had already passed the censure resolution, which is an early step toward impeachment, and so they'd handed it over. Goodlatte had it, and basically they had these experts testifying. It says here, quote, most of the experts testifying agreed that providing false testimony to Congress, which Republicans accused Koskinen of doing, satisfies the Constitution's impeachment standard.
Okay. Well, it's a frustrating day, and we're out of time. And I would like to discuss more. We actually had something else queued up, and we didn't get there because this is an important thing.
We We can talk about that on the next
program. That's right. We can get to that in the next program. It's actually tied into this. It's on a new constitutional convention, and we'll talk about that next week. An interview done. Well, on this issue, you know what we think. We now want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And we ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.